You're listening back to a Views and Brews discussion recorded in front of a live audience at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. We would love to have you be part of that live audience. Find out how you can join us for a free show anytime at cactuscafe.org. Hello, everyone. How are we doing back there, Will? Welcome, everyone, and thank you so much for coming out this evening for this wonderful show. It's always a pleasure to highlight the fantastic things going on in Austin, so this will be no exception. I'm Rebecca McEnroy with KUT, and I think we're ready. Will, do I have anything else, or we're good? Okay. I was looking around for quotes this evening because I think it's hard to talk about what art means to us. And sometimes people say it really, really well, and I found one that kind of spoke to what we're going to be talking about tonight, and it's from Marcel Duchamp. And he said, "What art is, in reality, is this missing link, not the links which exist. It's not what you see that is art. Art is the gap." So when we're thinking about these spaces that are here in our community where we can see art and experience art, sometimes we're left with the question of what does this all mean? And I think it's hard to know that until we come in contact with people who are doing incredible things in these spaces and changing lives for people. And this happens almost every day at the Blanton Museum. So here with me tonight to talk about reimagining museums as a space for healing, we have... I'm just going to give a brief synopsis of what they do, but really it's so much more than I'm saying. The Director of Education and Academic Affairs at the Blanton Museum, welcome Ray Williams. Thank you for joining us. Also, we have here this evening a professor in psychiatry here at UT at the Dell Medical School. Also, the, at Seton, but I can't remember what. You're a psychiatrist at Seton. Yes, okay, of course. Dr. Valerie Rosin, thank you for joining us. Welcome. And museum educator here at the Blanton Museum. She works with art and art therapy. Also, she makes all of the Blanton accessible to all of Austin and works to understand what that means on a daily basis. Monique O'Neill, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And the Deputy Director of Age of Central Texas, Annette Juba, thank you for coming this evening. So I just briefly introduced you, but let's talk a little bit about what brings you to this conversation and what role you play at the Blanton and in the community. I'll start with you, Annette.
Okay, thank you. So Age of Central Texas serves older adults and their caregivers. One of our programs is called Memory Connections. It's a weekly, very proactive program for people in the early stages of a disorder like Alzheimer's disease or some other sort of memory loss. And we know that our participants who come to the program really thrive on events out in the community. And we were really excited to partner with the Blanton to create a safe and a fun and a supportive experience in a environment that otherwise might be really intimidating.
Monique?
Yeah, I think when the initial time that we spoke and began to collaborate and have these conversations and what would this look like working with the care partners that have their loved one with early onset memory loss and this museum experience, and what does that look like? Is it that we're really focusing on the memory loss? Are we focusing just on the caregiver? And so collaborating together, really trying to form a program that met both needs, that the participant with the early memory loss was there to be able to have an outing, to have a social experience, and also to have fun. The caregiver was there, instead of being a caregiver, all of a sudden the role of wife, son, mother-in-law, they could play that role and be in a place that also was fun, but that they could relax and just have their own shared experience, and at the same time have an experience with their partner that has early onset memory loss, but in a place where they're supported. It was safe. If something went wrong, there wasn't a need to be embarrassed. There wasn't a need to be feeling like, oh, I have to fix it, that hypervigilance feeling of what do I do, I was there to be able to look at them and let them know we're all here in it together, and I'm here to facilitate that behavior or that incident. And
I think that attention to the to people's vigilance is what ties the program that you do for Memory Connections with the program that you do with your patients. Because what we hear from caregivers is that it's exhausting sometimes to be protecting the person that you're caring for from everything out there, to constantly be surveying what's going around, and to be able to jump in and respond when they need some support. And you create that space so that you're the one who is surveying and making sure everything's okay, and they can just enjoy together. And that's a really unique thing.
I never thought I would hear so much laughter in our gallery experiences together. Everything is shared yet independent, and it's a moment of fun. It's also challenging for us as educators, that really having to learn and re-trigger our brain on how we teach in the galleries on this object-based teaching. And there's a lot of recall for us when we're looking at art and doing close looking and asking people to bring their own shared experiences into these works. And with working with early onset, we have to be really in the present and here and now. So how do you honor the caregiver's experience, but also honor the early memory loss participant and where they are presently?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dr. Razem, what brings you to the panel?
Well, the program that we run at Seton is called the RESTORE program, and it's an intensive outpatient program for patients who've experienced trauma and who have PTSD. So we have one for civilians and one for veterans. And in this particular space, there's lots of evidence-based treatment these days for PTSD that's pretty effective. But about 50% of our patients, after a six-week program, they no longer have PTSD, which is great. But that also leaves a large percentage that still do. So part of our program was to add different components that might be helpful in addition to the evidence-based talking therapy, because we feel that sometimes trauma can get stuck in the body. And so we have resilient yoga. We have some skills to deal with emotions and resilience in general. And then what we do with the Blanton is we've created some outings. It's not true for everybody, but the majority of people who have experienced trauma often don't like to go out in public. It's uncomfortable to be in spaces they're less familiar with. And so if you're a good therapist, you might tell your patient, you need to go out in public. You need to volunteer. If they were a church-going person, you need to go back. And the patients all shake their heads and say, that's a great idea, but no one does it because they're afraid. So as part of our group, we force everybody together on a bus so that people don't have the excuse of running into traffic, not having gas, X, Y, and Z, no avoidance. And we go together. And the collaboration between Ray and I for civilians and Monique and I for veterans now is really to give them this space where they can actually become comfortable. They go with their therapist. So the first time when it's scary, we'll say things like, what's the worst thing that can happen in a museum where there are security folks, your two therapists, and a psychiatrist? It's hard to come up with really scary things that might happen in that scenario. And so what we do is we look at art. We don't talk about their trauma that day, but we look at the art in such a way that we use the same kind of tools we're teaching them to test their thoughts about their trauma, to experience the art, to sort of see different perspectives, to understand what they think might happen may not be the full story. And then another thing folks with PTSD have issues with is they're hypervigilant, similar to you guys. And so we have a private tour, but there may be third graders or second graders on a tour in the Blanton, so their startle response is tested. They can't have their back to the wall to see everything because the art's there and you can't touch it. So they're tested in ways where at the end, the outcome is that they recognize they can do something that's actually fun and pleasant, and it's not as scary as they originally thought.
And Ray, I would love for you to tell us what brings you to this conversation, but also what a traditional museum experience has been like. And then we can talk about how you're all reimagining that experience and what that looks like.
Well, I think when most people sort of picture what a museum, a group visit to an art museum will be like, you know, they think about the very long tradition of being greeted by a knowledgeable museum representative, maybe a curator, maybe a docent, who is going to sort of lead you around the gallery spaces and tell you important information that you don't know, but they do. And that model works for some people, but as museum educators really have been sort of instrumental in sort of breaking away from the information-driven model into a more experiential model. And I think the other thing that, and that's now, that's the museum education norm. You know, lots of open-ended questions, real curiosity about what people are seeing and thinking and feeling in the encounter with works of art. I think what we're doing with some of these partnerships, and I have to say that the partnership is critical here. I mean, Monique is trained as an art therapist. I have no therapy background and don't pretend to, but I know how to learn from strong partners, and I know how to read, and I'm a good facilitator. I know about the collections. So we're really trying to, through these partnerships, develop some new models that expand our thinking about what the art museum might be for people, how it might really be transformative and helpful, especially to people who are having some hard times.
And I just wanted to hone in on one thing you said, which was like, you're making models, you know, that can be replicated across the country. And I thought, it is such an incredible space, the Blanton. I mean, we did a show a while ago on teaching art through, or teaching social justice through art. And that program itself is working with kids, working with schools, and just an incredible program that not a lot of museums, none that I knew of before that, had taken on to give space to that type of curiosity and that type of experience and experimentation. So talk about a little bit, like, what is it like? You know, say that I come with my parent or loved one, and they're suffering from dementia, early onset dementia. What is the experience like for us when we go into the museum when we work with you?
Well, I think Monique can talk us through what exactly happens when they go in, but what our participants tell us is that it's a time where they can, again, just enjoy being together. One woman in one of our surveys at the end said, at the end of her tour, she felt like dancing with her husband in the lobby, and they haven't gone out dancing in years. One of our staff members who was there said she noticed a husband and wife holding hands in an affectionate way, as opposed to holding your hand and, you know, come with me to do this thing. I think the other thing that is really positive about this experience in an art museum is that there's no wrong answer with the art. What you see and what it brings to your mind is your absolute truth, and you know, it can't be argued against. So to be in a place where there's no wrong answer is really, really positive. I think people with memory loss a lot of times are so conscious about wanting to get things right, wanting to have the right answer, wanting to remember the right things. And in the art museum, whatever comes to your mind is right.
I think that's one thing, too, which is new about the way that you're approaching the museum experience. I've been in museums, and especially with groups of people, where I know that I'm silently being judged for reading a little bit too closely, that little, you know, thing that they have beside the painting, and not taking it in as I'm supposed to take it in. And I think allowing space to just be with art and to experience what you're experiencing and not judge and not say there's a right way or a wrong way to experience this, that is, that in itself is groundbreaking. There's one quote by Walter Benjamin where he said that working with memory collapses time. And I wonder about the museum experience and the space as collapsing time, and other experiences in our day-to-day life where we're just kind of going with the flow, and there aren't very many spaces where we can stop.
Yeah, I think the way that we, when we got together and designed, it's very similar to what Valerie was sharing about getting them out of the house and be willing to actually go somewhere to do something, that it was really important for Ray and I when speaking with Casey, another member of AGE, and Annette, was that we need this to be a community. This is an engagement. This is a gathering. This is a social experience of they all come on a bus together with their counselor or the lead of the program. That's so they come in together. They've already kind of began to chat. Some are familiar with one another. Some aren't. So they're already beginning to form these relationships. And then coming into the museum, it's how we're greeting them. But Ray said this beautifully, is that it really takes good partnership. We may be skilled in our particular area of museum education or my past experience with art therapy, but not specifically with veterans or citizen trauma or with early memory loss. And so we really had to learn and take that in. This wasn't about just come to the museum and let me show you around and have a good time. I had to think about what's the best place for them to be greeted. Everybody, myself and staff included, wear headsets, whether you need them or not, a small listening device. And the way I say it is, you know, I want you to be able to hear everything I have to say. If you can't hear me, you probably turned me off. And it's just the way that to let everybody have an opportunity, if they're stopped or slowed down, that they can hear us. The way that we think about the works and the visits, because this is a three-part visit. What's funny, in 2 years, these three-part visits, everyone keeps coming back and repeating, and they don't even mind if it's something similar. But we think of themes in the sense of movement, color, everyday objects, relationships, something that's foundational that they can connect with. So we're not diving into the art history. We're not diving into the artist necessarily. We're looking at works that we're consistently reminding them that this is about relationships. This is about our object material. So we're looking at things that are familiar to them that can tell a story, and reminded that we're talking about the here and now. So asking them about not, do you remember a time when, or can you recall, really, what is it that we're looking at? What do you see? What do you see that's familiar to you? And that gets the conversation. And what's really beautiful is you were sharing about these wives or husbands that were there saying, I wanted to dance or hold hands. You can see it as they're looking at the artwork, because most those with the memory loss will recall and kind of recenter themselves in a place of past, of in a time period that maybe they've gone back, but their caregiver is talking about the moment. And so sometimes you can sense these kind of sad moments where you went somewhere else, but then at the same time they're sharing this experience, and you do in the middle, you see them laugh together or touch one another, or a son look over at his dad and back up at us and just like, wow, we're here together, we're having this moment, and there's no embarrassment. We're meeting them where they're at. But just like we have to consider about exits and where people are positioned, it's not just about the memory loss, it's also about perception and perspective and vision. Sometimes I have to be very intentional about directing about what we're looking at and using my arms to share what we're looking, because sometimes they'll start talking about a work of art that's actually in another gallery. And it's just the way that their vision, or just with the PTSD or the trauma, having to think about all the other people in the space. So there's so many parts to be mindful of that we really need to meet them where they're at. But we can do that because we've partnered so well and are learning so much from our collaborators.
And this idea of partnering, you know, I mean, really, how do these collaborations come up? How does this happen? How do you all come together? I mean, you're all leading the way in these fields and in this work. Talk about, like, how did that even happen? And what were your barriers to make this happen? And was this something that, you know, when you started out in the beginning of your career, you're like, well, this is what I want to do, and I'm going to partner with museums as a psychiatrist? Or how did that work?
So that wasn't it. When I was working at Seton, Ray was asked to give a grand rounds where he talked about his experience of educating groups of physicians on museum tours. And it just sort of sparked something where I thought, hey, our trauma folks could really use something like that. And I just kind of attacked Ray afterwards and said, is this something you would be interested in the future?
Well, the way I remember it, you said, do you know anything about PTSD and trauma? And I said, not yet, but I like to learn new things.
Well, playing up on that, I know the first time we started talking about dementia and proposed doing this, and you came back on the next phone call and said, I've gotten these three books that I'm reading, and you are way ahead of the curve on learning what all we were going to be working with.
Yeah. So what have you learned? Like, what did these partnerships look like for you? Because you're constantly thinking, how can I rediscover this museum space? So what was it like for you to learn about this and to create these partnerships?
Well, a couple of things come to mind working with the trauma survivors. And I think one thing that I've really learned is it's helped me grow as a person and become more generous. I feel more alert to the variety of experiences that people bring to them, whether that's in the museum or anywhere out on the street. I just feel a little bit more generous about why somebody might be behaving a little oddly, or a little bit more understanding about why I might look scary to somebody. So that's one level of learning. And the other thing that was kind of delightful to discover as, Dr. Rosen gave me the lay person's good book to learn about trauma, The Body Keeps the Score. And as we sort of experimented together about what this new design for a new audience might look like, I was really struck by the very natural parallels between what I'm used to teaching in terms of an interpretive approach and what she's teaching in terms of being aware of how your brain is operating and how to compensate for the way that trauma might have skewed your normal responses. And so for just to make that more concrete, like when we look at art, I'm going to say what we do when we look at art, and you're going to underscore how that resonates with the therapy, okay? So when we look at art, the first thing we do is slow down and really get in touch with the details of the imagery. And then often a first question might be, what's your first reaction? Like, so noticing your first response, but also like implied is you don't have to stick with your first response. It's just your first response. It might develop over the 20 minutes that we're going to be talking about this work of art together. And then, along the way, based on the visual evidence, what's there before us, people start generating interpretive theories. It might mean this, but I'm going to say, and what else might it mean? So we sort of get the practice that within a group of people looking at one thing, our lived experiences, our personalities might lead us to different understandings. So that is one thing that happens.
Should I say the analogous part?
Go ahead.
When Ray was saying that part of what he wants them to do is to sort of slow down and take a look at the picture, a lot of times if people are agitated or feeling stressed, part of the grounding technique is to have them really get in touch with their senses that they're feeling, to pull them away from their thoughts. So that's helpful. Also, being in the present moment, similarly to what you guys were talking about, is really important, because if you've had trauma, you're fearing the future or you're afraid of what happened to you in the past, but you miss this thing called the present. So it's also very nice to realize you can relax in the present. And then the part about being able to have different opinions or thoughts about what something might mean is really a part of cognitive processing therapy that we're doing, because often when someone's traumatized, they make an assumption erroneously that somehow it was their fault, or they should have done something different, or they could have done something better. and that gives them the illusion of control. And part of the treatment is to have them look at the evidence of what actually occurred and recognize there might be an alternate view. Like, it might not have been their fault. It might have been just a bad situation where they had no control. So it's kind of nice because that sort of ties the two together.
And, you know, after experiencing trauma or loss, there's an attempt to weave together our story, our life story again, you know, and it's funny when we were talking beforehand, you had this great anecdote by Robert Carr and that you were talking about. And I'd love for you to talk about that and then to talk about the role that museums play that is outside of, you know, who we are on a daily basis. All of the I'm here fully formed on a daily basis, and the way that museums take us back and allow us to become something else.
Right, because there are so many times and places and perspectives represented in that one building. It's a beautiful resource. So the person that sometimes inspires me is now deceased, but David Carr, a librarian museum professional, and he thinks about the role of cultural institutions in contemporary life. And one of the things that he writes about that really struck home to me was that the museum is a resource for visitors in the process of becoming, that idea of becoming. And that whether or not the museum invites it, empowered visitors can put it to use as they pursue their own questions and their own process of becoming. And of course, the problem is, you know, many visitors don't feel empowered to make it their own and are looking for the invitation from the museum. So when the invitation is only learn this new material, that isn't inviting, but some of these new models, as you say, meeting people where they are and really trying to design for a variety of human needs, because art is just, it's just big. It is too big to be confined by a disciplinary perspective or by mere facts, and it's very grounded in diverse human experience, and that's why we have these collections. You know, object-based teaching, the objects come from different cultural and different human situations.
Yeah, I was reminded when Ray was saying that a particular veterans group working with, there was a line we use at the end to kind of reflect, and it's, I used to think, but now I think. And we have a two-week of the fifth and the sixth week of the session. And I remember one saying, I used to think art was just about the artist. And now, she said, now I know the art is about a shared experience. And looking at it, I was so hesitant about, why do I need to look at this? This is, has nothing to do with me. And it's hard when I hear our visitors say, I don't see myself on these walls. We all may not look the same, but we share similar heartache. We shared similar trauma. We share similar experiences, similar loves. You have to do the work to find it. You have to sit there longer than the 14 seconds that usually an art goer will look at a work of art. To learn about the art, you have to do the same thing to engage with a human. You won't get to know someone if you just spend 14 seconds. You've got to be uncomfortable. Stay there for 20, stay there for 30. And the more we do that with these participants, they're all of a sudden realizing, this is similar to my story, or I can understand, or I can find a sense of connection, that it's, that they're a part of that.
And another thing it makes me think of are the threshold experiences we have in our lives. You know, that, and just going through our days, we don't have that many where we are one person, and then we step through a threshold and we are another person, you know? I guess there's going to sleep and waking up, which I've heard is a threshold experience, but then you wake up. But, you know, especially for people who are suffering from dementia, who are suffering from PTSD, finding space where they can have those threshold experiences. You are changed when you leave. I mean, that is an important and sacred space. Maybe talk about how your patients experience that.
I think for me, one of the most powerful things a Memory Connections participant told us was that when they were in Memory Connections, that was when they felt like they could truly be themselves. That when they were out in the world, they had, again, to try to give right answers and know the right information. So the art museum is that threshold of being able to just be yourself.
I think similarly, one of the things that the patients really like about the Blanton is with trauma, really doesn't matter what type of trauma someone's experienced. A lot of times you feel like you're damaged or something's wrong with you, and many times that's because an abuser has actually said that to you. And so being able to go on a private tour with a museum educator, it allows people to feel a little bit important, like, wow, I'm worthy of this experience. And then as it's been discussed, there's no right or wrong answer. So they also get a feeling that whatever they say about the art, their opinion is important, and that helps build self-esteem too.
And I think also at the Blanton, it's not just about what Ray and I as museum educators and other colleagues of ours, but it's really our whole institution. I mean, this is working with our gallery assistants that know when we're working with those in the galleries that are mindful. I mean, their job is to protect the art, right? But when they're aware of who we're with, or that sensitivity of, as Ray was mentioning earlier, that every visitor is different, everyone has different needs, they may need to be up a little bit closer.
The first time I worked with one of your groups, there was a patient who needed to bring in a bottle of water. And it wasn't because she was thirsty, but it was like a touchstone for her for self-soothing. And, you know, bottles of water are not allowed in the galleries. Make no mistake.
I have been told many times by you.
However, I went to the security person who was right there, and I said, you know, this is a fragile group. She would like to bring a bottle of water in for self-soothing purposes. Could we just make an exception this time? And the person said, oh, yes, of course. And let me radio my colleagues so that they'll all know that this has been okay. And I just thought, yes, that's the institution we work for, with supportive, flexible colleagues who, but don't bring water in there, but unless you really need to.
No, but the point in that is that I think what we're trying to do is create not just this art museum where you walk in and you feel like, I've got to catch the 15 best works of art. It's, no, come in, and if it's 30 minutes, 15, look at one, look at two. How are you connecting with it? What's it saying for you? Then come back and visit again, that this is a place that we're wanting people to come for respite, for joy, on a date, for their lunch, with their care partner, on their own, with someone else to share the experience. We're all about engagement.
I want to be really concrete and tell an object-based story. So like one of the key works that we look at in almost every one of the restore groups is a very large portrait of Madam C.J. Walker, America's first self-made female millionaire, a very important person in American history. She made her fortune by creating, manufacturing, and marketing beauty products for black women in the early part of the 20th century. So we have this very large portrait. And it's, I hope that some of you have seen it. If not, I hope you'll be teased into going to the Blanton on the second floor to check this out. But the way that we work with it, and it's to, it's for a couple of reasons, which I hope will become clear. We look at it first from about 50 feet away. And we have a conversation about what might we infer about the sitter of this portrait? What can you tell? And people say things like, it's a woman, maybe a black woman, maybe from the 1920s based on that hairstyle. And then I say, what might you infer about her character? She looks dignified or mad, you know, because people have different reactions to these images, right? But we have a list of things that might be part of her character. And then I give some biographical information about this person who was born in 1867 to enslaved parents. She was orphaned and widowed with a young child by the time she was 20. So this first 20 years is incredible poverty and loss, but it's in a story of incredible resilience. So it's this model for a resilient life, but we're still 60 feet away. Then we go like 2 feet away. We don't ever go closer than 2 feet, mind you. But when you get 2 feet away, you lose the sense of portraiture. You can't really read it as a figure anymore. But what you learn is that it's made out of 3,800 plastic combs that Sonia Clark, the artist, has sort of manipulated to create that what is a portrait from 60 feet and is a grid of broken combs from 2 feet away. So again, the embodied experience underscores that therapeutic principle of look at things from different points of view, and this rewards that. It's very clear we learn something different from 60 feet, but we still don't know the whole thing.
And I just want to, we're going to open it up for questions in a second, but can you comment on what's happening in the brain when that type of experience happens?
Well, I think part of what we look at is, you know, in PTSD, the part of the brain that gives you the fight or flight and the big PTSD symptoms is the amygdala. That's the fear portion of the brain. And then the prefrontal cortex is the part where we have more of the ability to analyze a situation and assume that we're safe. And so part of the therapy and part of the experience in the Blanton is when you have to talk and think and actually use your words, you turn on your prefrontal cortex. And then it has the ability to sort of shut down your amygdala and let you know that you can relax, that things are safe. Often when people have PTSD, the prefrontal cortex kind of goes offline. So you don't have that ability to kind of regulate yourself and recognize that you're safe. And the mere act of talking and thinking about art or about your trauma allows that part of the brain to be turned on, which then reduces your sympathetic drive. It's like a four-year-old who's tantruming in the corner. If the teacher says, Susie, use your words, as soon as she's able to say what she wants, she can calm. So that's an active part of what's happening in the brain.
So it's resetting your sympathetic nervous system? Yeah. How did you know my nickname was Susie? That's what's interesting, because it's true. Well, I would love to open things up for questions. And Amy has the mic, so she'll just be coming around. Just raise your hand if you have a question. Feel free to not ask a question. Right here.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for speaking to us. I'm really interested in, so if we were to take up Ray's exhortation to go see a painting in the second floor of the Blanton, what are some strategies besides like prolonged viewing that maybe a solo viewer or a pair of viewers who pop in between classes or after class might use in front of a painting alone or together to achieve the same kind of effect without a group leader, or maybe if they're alone and they can't do this same kind of verbalization? Are there strategies that a solo or unled small group of viewers can use together in the galleries?
Well, I believe Ray was a part of designing that. We have two self-guided materials actually that live at our museum at the front desk, that we have the tortoise and the hare. So that's someone that's there for wanting more of a slow view. And then the hare, obviously, if you only have a short amount of time. And I think it gives a really nice way of when you're, how you're looking and when you're there, what to think about. And then our second one, which is my favorite.
The personal response
prompt. The personal response. You want to share about
that? So those are, you know, those are prompts that invite people to make a personal connection. I really think the answer to your question is like the invitation to make the experience your own. And drawing is a great way to see more. If you slow down and draw, you're going to notice more details. Noticing your own reaction and comparing it to your viewing partner's reaction is, you know, it's a conversation starter. I think these experiences can teach us about ourselves and the people who are with us, as well as the original context and what the artist was caring about.
Yeah, and I always tell my groups or anyone I said, even though you mentioned this, Rick, about don't read the wall label. It's they're inching and inching when we get there. That's the first thing they want to know. They want the information. They want to be told what it is. They don't want to be like put in this, I don't know anything. And I have, this is the first thing. Don't be tempted. This white, nice little shiny box that's there with some words on it. Because it's like a peanut butter jar. It's got all the ingredients on the back, and it's telling you all the little bits of what's made of. It's giving you the calories. And then you look over on the other side, and it's giving you the brand, the title, where it was made, their slogan. I want you to be able to hide from that and just, not that that's not important, but for the first experience is, don't know anything about it. Imagine, what is that material from that, you know, 2 feet or further, or from that 50 feet getting them closer? What are the materials? What are the subjects? What are you seeing? What are the colors?
Get a spoon,
right? you're diving and you're taking longer. It's back to what we talked about, spending longer than 14 seconds. We're in such a rush. We just want to know it. We want to get the information and we want to move on. So don't read the label. Also, we all stand still. It's like watching television. You're not on your sofa. Move around. Look at it from different perspectives. Be awkward and squat. Be awkward and turn your head over. Be awkward and look from the side. It's amazing what different views you'll get and perspectives, especially how our light is in the galleries, of what something that maybe you didn't see because it was in the bright shadow from another light. So just, I think for me is that first, don't read the label, then imagine what's that title. And as Ray said, bringing that sketchbook, you don't even have to be an artist.
And then read the label, because you have the capacity to be really curious about other times and places, which is one of the, you know, great things that art and fiction can do for us. I mean, we think a lot about cultivating the empathetic imagination and learning about different cultural experiences, you know, through the art.
It heightens, right? That wall label then, yes, do read it. But I ask people just to pause. So then all of a sudden, if you are alone, the museum, then you're having, honestly, you're having a conversation with the artist through this label, with this information that you're getting.
It also reminds me of how memory and trauma is stored in the body. You know, like hearing you talk about being uncomfortable and looking around, or, you know, just the act of touching a hand, or all of these things, like memory and trauma are stored in our body, and this kind of allows us to break a little bit and move around in a different way. How important is that in your experiences of working with people with dementia and with trauma survivors?
I think for the people with dementia, the art gives a concrete thing to hang on to. So as opposed to sitting in a support group and talking about how you experienced this or how your day was or what you remember about whatever, art gives you a concrete object you were talking about to start that conversation, as opposed to having to come up with some sort of abstract thought. I think the other thing that this experience in the museum really does comes from your talking about building connections. We know that living with memory loss, being a caregiver, can be really isolating experiences. You don't know if anybody else knows what you're going through, is going through the same thing, understands. And being able to come and do this normal experience with a group of other people is really empowering. We want to build connections with people who are feeling like they're not, that it's not as easy to get out and about.
And also the way that we're having these conversations with the artwork, whether it's with the early memory loss or times I'm working with Valerie's veterans group, is really that it's not just about looking. We all are different learners and take in information. And sometimes you're not so vulnerable to share, or maybe you don't have the words or the cognitive ability at the moment. So just because maybe your head's down doesn't mean they're not listening. I've learned my cues on when to approach, but having a tactile, having something that they're able to manipulate, mm-hmm. to hold on to make and create that is another way to create the art. Ray's with his combs, with the Madam C.J. Walker that's made out of that, worked one time with the veterans group, and I gave everybody a comb, the same type of comb that was in the piece as we read the bio of Madam C.J. Walker. And, you know, fidgets are such a new thing now, right? Always having, even adults need something to have. But just holding on to that comb that meant so much and what the artist was trying to say. And on it, when you go visit, you'll see it says unbreakable on the comb. So you're working with these participants that feel breakable, that feel like they're broken. So to be seeing a work of art, discussing resilience, but also being able to be tactile and touch and immerse in a safe and appropriate way through our guided experiences is, I think, another way that we're meeting them where they're at.
And when you do that, when you give them a card with the art on it or an object to take home, you're helping to extend that program beyond just the time in the museum. So again, somebody with memory loss, if the caregiver tried to say, "Do you remember when we did this?" they might not, but you've given them something that's that cue of, oh, yes.
Yes. Annette's talking about at the end of our visit together, they each get, each couple, we provide them with a bag that's got a shared snack, shared water, so they're having, again, now kind of like community feast together. And also we put in a card, and it's four-sided, and it has the four works blown up nice size and in big print of the four works that we've seen, and the information from the wall label, because we might not necessarily get to that. They do, some of them want to know, but this is a way then that they could go back, and it's something that they have that they can reflect back on, that they can have their conversation with, that they can have a shared moment back.
And those beautiful little gift bags at the end happen for two reasons. One, because Monique is an artist and everything she touches turns into something beautiful. And two, because Age wrote the Blanton into one of their grants. And so there actually is some money that supports, you know, transportation and snacks and, you know, even some of the educator time. So that's something that we do not take for granted in the partnership, and that I know the Blanton really appreciates. You know, the Blanton has really invested heavily in an education department. We have six educators, and we work in various parts of the community. We mostly spend money for the museum. We're sort of looking for some earned income streams through partnerships and corporate team building events and things like that.
Right. We definitely couldn't make it, I think, as rich in the extent that we want to without our partners that are also able to contribute. And the funds that we're getting, we're not just supporting them, but they're also supporting our work. So it's so great to work with those that we believe in what they're doing and they believe in what we're doing.
Valerie?
And I think one thing I wanted to say about how nicely these guys collaborate. Somebody had said to me, "Well, can't you just add another museum into the program?" And I was like, "That's not what it is. You can't just walk into a museum and it just happens." You know, there's a lot of thought that Monique and Ray put into their programming. And I think for the folks with trauma, one of the things that we work with them about is we say, so when you no longer have PTSD, what are you going to do with all your time? And a lot of times when you have PTSD, that's really taken up so much of your everyday, every second thinking that you forget that you can have things that are enjoyable. And I think the Blanton experience really allows them to connect with art in a way they never have done before, or maybe they had done prior when they had not had a trauma, and it's a nice way to reconnect. Yeah.
Another question? Right in the back.
Thank you. I actually have two questions. One is handicapped accessibility to the museums, the Blanton, HRC. There's a number of them where, like, HRC lost both of its disabled parking spaces. They're now staff parking. And the Blanton, although the parking garage is relatively close, by the time you walk from the parking garage around to the front of the Blanton, for some of us with disabilities, that's really difficult to impossible. And my second question is, are there any plans in the works to reach out to people with other kinds of mental disabilities, bipolar, depression, things like that? These things don't improve as you age. If anything, they deepen because your medications don't work like they used to and so forth. So those are my two questions. Thank you.
Well, I'll maybe do this. Well, the first question, I think one thing that will be happening at the Blanton over the next couple of years is a major sort of redesign of our plaza, our spatial relationship to campus, to the Capitol, the emerging sort of pedestrian walkway to the Capitol, and to Brazos Garage. So I'm sure that we're going to have improved parking, handicap parking, as well as school drop-off parking, because we see like 14,000 school visitors a year. So this is something that's going to be happening. I don't know what our current situation is. I do know that our visitor services staff are very generous and hospitable when they get a phone call saying, meet me at the corner, I need some assistance. That's not the way it's supposed to be, and it's not the way it will be in the future. But that's the hospitality that we have. In terms of opening up this kind of programming, it's partly why we were really eager to do this panel, because we think that, other therapists who are working in a sort of cognitive behavioral mode, maybe they're working with addiction. Autism is also something that we've talked about. We are just very interested in working with strong collaborators, developing new ways of being with people in the art museum that might influence the broader field. It's why we're at a university museum surrounded by passionate faculty partners, community leaders who can think with us. We have support for being innovative, and then we can publish and, influence what's happening at big municipal museums that have a lot more pressure around numbers than we do. So we're experimental, and we're really eager to learn more about how the art museum can support people. But I think addiction is an area that would fit very nicely in what we've been learning through the work with trauma.
I'd like to just, your first question, being a family and community programs, we're reminded daily that a lot of our audiences know we're a university museum, so we're part of UT. That is my number one every day, is what's the accessibility for everybody regardless, but particularly location, how do you get there, if you need special parking, when you arrive, how comfortable and accessible is it moving through the galleries and our elevator and our entrance. So as Ray said, the upcoming renovations, but this is something that I'm constantly reaching out, and it's a conversation with the university, but as Ray said, our visitor service, we try to do our best with what we have now. So those, please, that's some the information that we're feedback we're wanting to hear, so that we can continue to do better and be better, not just for the museum but for the community.
So we've come to the top of the hour, which is, always goes way too fast, which is crazy. But I'd like to end by just asking you, what you need in order to thrive with these programs. You know, what are the challenges that you have, and how can people get involved, and what do you need to sustain them and to make them grow? Go ahead, Anna.
Absolutely. Well, I think the crucial thing is great collaborative partners. So thank you to the Blanton for being so deliberate with us and designing an experience that was going to be really great for our clients. I think beyond that, funding helps all of these things get put in place at a very high level. We want to offer programming that's very affordable to the people who need it. So funding to help support that's crucial. We also really, really appreciate and need volunteers. We look for people who are interested in coming and helping to facilitate groups with us every week with our folks with memory loss. I think sometimes people are hesitant maybe to volunteer with people who are aging and people who have memory loss, thinking that it's just marked by loss and grief. I have worked with older adults for my entire career, and it is the best group of folks to work with. So people who are interested in volunteering.
There's many groups I look forward to, Valerie, but my connections at the Blanton group, it's been a 2-year long collaboration, come monthly every third Thursday, and my kids know when I come home and that I've worked with them, and not that I've worked with them, that I've been with them, that I've it's been the most fun and the most filling, and I learn more from them than I think that they gain from me.
And I think for us, we've been very happy with the Blanton's generosity, because we have not been able to pay them for their part in our grant. So they're super good collaborators. We are working on getting some grants to help with that. And I think for our program, besides the Blanton, if there are people out there with trauma, part of the diagnosis is that they have avoidance. So our hardest piece is actually getting the folks who need to come in for treatment to give us a try. Currently, we have a grant for veterans where our program is a $7,000 program, and through Seton and the grant, it's actually free. They can get rides to and from the program every day via our connection with Lyft. This will end at the end of November. So if any patients are out there and interested in trying us, I'm going to put in a plug. 512-324-2039 is a way to get an intake, which is also free.
We'll put that on the link to the podcast also. And online, they can find you?
Yep, online if you just Google Restore Program through Seton.
Great. Ray, what do you need in order to thrive?
I think imagination and generosity come up for me. Just like the sort of open-minded sense of possibility.
Well, every time I go to the Blanton, I'm reminded of that. So it's all right there. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for coming out and sharing this experience with us. And I would encourage everyone to get involved in these programs. Thank you to Ray, Valerie, Monique, and Annette. And thank you all for coming out to Infuse and Bruce. Please join us again October 1st as we join the Secret Ingredient team for another discussion about the Green New Deal and Austin. But for tonight, have a beautiful evening and drive safe. Thank you for coming out.